sounds really good.
It was what Nikwin meant to say. So it was the one the Russian wants to speak for him, supposedly. Okay, so thanks a lot for inviting me here, and it's my pleasure to be here and give this talk, and I hope to amuse you a bit here for the next hour, or maybe less, with quite an interesting connection between scalar fields, hydrodynamics of imperfect fluids, and cosmology.
Oh, it does. Okay, it does with delay.
Good. So, to begin with, I would like to say what I want to say, so my main message from the very beginning. So, first thing I would like to say is there are some non-canonical scalar fields which can act, even one single scalar field, can act like an imperfect fluid. So what do I assume about that? What do I think when I say imperfect fluid? That means that in general, if I do not restrict myself only to Friedman-Robertson local universe, in that case my energy momentum tensor does not have this form of the perfect fluid. It has a different form which deviates from perfect fluid form. So how one can achieve this strange property? Obviously with canonical scalar fields it doesn't work, so you need to go non-canonically. Moreover, you need to go to high derivative theories. So in particular, what you need to write kind of kinetic mixing, or what we call braiding, like this term. So here you can recognize this is a covariant box, and it is structurally similar to just kinetic mixing, for example, in gauge theories. So here derivative of one field tops derivative of another field. However, this works even quadratically. So here it is nonlinear. So what you have a derivative of the metric which is coupled to the derivative of the scalar field. Okay? Of course, it cannot be a covariant derivative of the metric because it will disappear.
And the word braid often has topological connotations.
Yeah,
is that
but
not
related. So, then this deviation from the perfect fluid structure and the appearance of high derivatives in the theory, they imply, in fact, very exotic and I think quite interesting from the mathematical at this point of view, opportunity to violate null energy conditions, the weakest and the most fundamental out of the energy conditions from the standard general relativity, and this violation can be manifestly stable. What do I mean under that? I mean that I'm a simple-minded man, I take what I have written, I do not assume that there are any new terms which should be included or should be not included, should be cut off or should not be cut off. I take what I have written, expand it around some given solution. This solution does violate null energy condition. Then I check the linear stability, namely I check whether the sound speed or sound speeds in some cases are positive, so I mean sound speed squared, and whether small perturbations in high frequency limit would not have ghosts, would not become ghosty. Okay? So the point is that this is possible to achieve even in minimally coupled theories. So I am not going to consider any couplings to curvature besides of this kind of implicit coupling which is there through this box. Okay? So, and the fourth point which connects it to hydrodynamics is the following. So if you have well, hydrodynamics means that there is something flowing here. So, usually it's some charge. In simple hydrodynamics, the charge is just mass. Yeah? So, what kind of charge can be organized out of one single scalar field? So, the only way is to consider shift charge. Okay? It's the charge with respect to just shifts in field space. That's the only charge which I can have from 1 degree of freedom. So, it's not complex, it's only one scalar field. So, and I will, of course, I mean continuous charge, right? So, one can, of course, have phi to minus phi, but that's not what is interesting here. So, what is interesting is that this shift charge produces your flow of charges or particles, if you want, and that the place where you do not have this shift charge, it's a very particular configuration, which corresponds to cosmological attractors. And in fact, it's exactly the same story as was in Gauss condensate on, or in like simplest first idea on K inflation. Okay? which was Bethke inflation because the sound speed was zero. So here, these attractors, however, are manifestly stable. And see, if you recall the story about Gauss condensers, there you needed to write higher derivatives, which naively would bring you Gauss. Then you had to cut off those degrees of freedom which were oscillating higher than faster than the cutoff. And every time, theoretically, you should do this procedure once again because you are every time on a different background. Okay? So here, this doesn't happen. So what I have written, I expand and I see that there are no Gauss, no gradient instabilities around, at least for some of the series, around these particular solutions. And the more interesting from the phenomenological point of view property of these solutions is that the properties of these attractors, they're not fixed just by my Lagrangian. They also depend on the dynamics of external matter in the universe. So for example, if you take Gauss condensate or this bad K inflation, then the solution where the shift charge is zero is just fixed. Okay? So you know your solution precisely, there is no new interesting things going on. However, here it will depend what, for example, dark matter will do. Okay? And in particular, the external matter influences the sound speed and other observable properties on these solutions. Moreover, these attractors generically evolve to the Sitter state in the late time. So that means that it's very interesting for dark energy phenomenology, because now we have a theory where you have attractor, so you do not depend on initial conditions strongly, and you also evolve to the Sitter, okay, through some complicated dynamical evolution. That's what makes this class of series interesting. Okay, now what I'm talking about, so this is of course much less sexy than this, so this is the braid, yeah, so we are taking phi and j mu nu, and we are trying to kind of mix them, okay? So what is it more asymmetrically? So for me, theory is an action, okay? That's a bad thing probably, but still, because we have no idea yet what is the physical meaning of the scalar field, what is the theory, yeah? So, let's take the first part, which is just the general function of this phi and x, where x is standard kinetic term, okay? Just the simplest invariant which you can build out of first derivatives. And then let's crank it up, okay? So this was already in DBI, came inflation, K essence, and these thousands of models. So let's now crank it up. Add another function, which we call G, and then I multiply it with box phi. Okay? So that's why you can guess. So this is K, this is G, and this is B. Right? So now what is this braid? Inside of this box, as you have seen in my first transparency from the summary, the Christoffel symbols, these Christoffel symbols contain first derivatives of the metric. Here you have first derivatives of the field phi, so they are kinetically mixed. Of course, if the derivative of this g with respect to x is zero, then there is no mix. Now, why it is interesting? Because, in fact, this action has a lot of similarities with just Einstein-Hilbert action. Okay? Let's see what are they. So first of all, the second derivatives, which are higher derivatives by our normal nomenclature, by our normal terminology, so these derivatives, they enter the action, however, only linearly. That's crucial. Recall Einstein-Hilbert term, they also have second derivatives of the metric in R, however, it enters only linearly. Second thing, okay. So one can eliminate these higher derivatives. Recall, in Einstein-Hilbert term, you can introduce particular reference frame and rewrite your, instead of nice geometric curvature Lagrangian, you would get gamma, 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 gamma in this particular frame. And of course, gammas are not tensors. So you have broken your Lorentz invariant formulation of your theory, but that's the price which you have to pay to kill this high derivative. Okay? On the other hand, if you start from Lorentz invariant nice formulation, geometrical formulation, then you do know that you do need boundary terms. Otherwise, your variational principle is not well posed. So you cannot get any reasonable equations out by Lagrangian. So here you need it as well. And the main point, which is the crucial point for us, is that despite all these high derivatives in the action, the equations of motion are still of the second order. So there are no new degrees of freedom. So why usually these new degrees of freedom are dangerous? Because, as you can see from this nice picture, this is the author of ghosts, okay? The only ghosts which are mathematically present. So this guy is Mikhail Vasilyevich Ostrogradsky, so the guy who proved for the first time. So if you have higher order equations of motion, in that case, if you want to write Hamiltonian describing them, in that case, this Hamiltonian is unbounded from below. And this unboundness is very bad because it's unboundness in P, in your momentum. And this unboundness is linear. So that's why there's no way you can find even local minima where it could be bounded. So what is important for us, because our equations are second order, so the ghosts of Mikhail Vasilyevich, they don't bother us, okay? They can safely forget about him. So there is only one degree of freedom, namely phi. Important difference from other scenarios like Gauss condensate and so on is the following, that there, naively, from purely mathematical perspectives, these Gauss are present there. And then we need to think physically and say, oh, what I have written, that's probably the oscillates too fast, I should cut them all, these new additional modes on physical or physical. And then this discussion can take you really far away. So here, we're just completely ignorant about this problem because this problem is not there.
Can you just explain why the equations are second order? Because from the action, it's
I will tell you just in a second. That's one of my main points. So, but that's of course a very striking feature of this. So, it is really connected to a really popular activity, recent activity, which is called Galilean fields. Okay. And of course, people have abused this as much as possible. But in fact, the original idea introduced by Alberto Nicolis, Riccardo Ratazzi, and Tinkerini in 2008 was, let's write a theory which would be similar to the decoupling limit of DGP, so would protect the following properties. So phi has a shift symmetry, and also there's additional shift symmetry, this Galilean shift symmetry, which is shift symmetry in derivatives. So here we do not require that. In fact, from our just simplest cosmological application, we just need that. Just shift symmetry. But we don't need to kill high derivatives. So in fact, we can use whatever functions I have written, they're k and g. And also, what is another important thing, what was usually disregarded by original guys and so on. So if you write these more complicated high derivative terms, because they want to write the most general action, which could be written in four dimensions, for example, for this Galilean symmetry. In that case, if you just take this action, okay, and I'm a simple man, I have this action, I should vary it and see what are my equations of motion. If I vary it with respect to the metric, then it's not second order equations, so ghosts are bad. So Mikhail Vasilyevich, welcome. Okay? So that's why, what's the point? So what we have found with Cedric Defayet and Esposito Ferrez is that the only way to keep these properties that you do not have ghosts, at least somewhere, is to introduce non-minimal coupling terms. Like, for example, this one. This looks horrible, but what can I say? So there are no better notation for this. But what's the point? So there are non-minimal coupling terms, and in many cases, people also include non-minimal couplings to the energy momentum tensor, like phi trace of t. So we do not have all that, okay? We are just simple-minded people. We want to have simplest theory there. And then you can see a bit structure of this non-canonical field theory. So the first example was this DBI, KS, and so whatever. And in fact, very well forgotten all the activity which was even in papers by Heisenberg from 1937, I think, about cosmic rays. So then if you want this class of theories, it includes all theories like this. Then there is this decoupling limit of DGP, and this class, so what we are considering is basically higher, so it includes this DGP decoupling limit. Then there is this general Galilean. So this general Galilean includes, of course, the decoupling limit of DGP, but basically that's our only intersection there.
So all the stability is always essentially at the classical level. Are you worrying about relative stability in the field? Whether other terms?
That's interesting thing, so, but that's hard to make because it should be analyzed for particular background, because background, if background is important, then you have expanded first quadratically, and then integrate out high frequency modes and see what other operators generated there. So that we have not done.
Okay, sorry.
But this would be a good point to look at, of course. Okay, so now how we can recall what is this, okay? Just very, very naive, loose motivation for this. So what is in this case on SDI? So you take this normal kinetic term X, and then you think, okay, there's some correction, some expansion, okay, which you can write there. And this expansion is in this X, okay, with some coefficients which in general can depend on phi. And then, suppose by some miracle, somebody said to you that you can sum this expansion up and obtain, for example, nice dBi, square root, okay? Here what we do is just neurologically very, very similar. The only difference, let's take the first kinetic term which was there, and if we do know we can integrate it by parts, this would be the same theory, and now let's write the same correction. And suppose once again that we can sum it up. So what we consider is basically the sum of these two expansions. Now, why equation of motion is of the second order? So if you directly write the action, that's what you get, this monstrosus equation. Sorry, but I just need to convince you. So it has a term which is linear and second derivative, so there's a tensor L, which means that it multiplies the linear part. And all the tensors L, Q, and scalar Z, they depend on first derivatives, metric, and field, okay? And nothing else. So that's just the way to describe what is the structure with respect to second derivatives. So what is surprising, it has a contribution which is quadratic in second derivatives. That's a contribution which is kind of standard. And what is really striking, what we call Brady, there is a Ricci tensor appearing there. And that's the key point. Why their high derivatives disappeared? So if you go back to the action, then what we call there was this Bob's phi multiplied, if you want, this kinetic term, a function of kinetic term. If you do your variation, then this box would apply on kinetic term. That's a derivative. However, if you write kinetic term, then there would be first derivative with minus sign, which is applied on box. And the combination of the third derivatives is such that there is a commutator of these derivatives. And the commutator provides you exactly this Arminian. Okay?
Sorry, the term in the middle, the one that has the Q, so you have second derivatives as well there. So so you're going on and so what are you gonna do with that term?
I will explain. Okay. So this term, the point is that this equation which looks completely ugly, horrible, and so on, and I think your question is related to the following discussion. So in fact this Q alpha beta mu, the term which by the way we will not need to discuss here, is such that there this equation can be considered as 4D Lorentzian generalization of the so-called Monge-Ampere equation. What do I mean? So before that, I didn't know about this equation either, so don't be surprised. But this was a quite a modern thing, so people are doing this. So what is important is that this term is such that if you plug in there any coordinates, whatever you want, okay, everything is generally covariant, as you can see, then the structure is such that any second derivative with the same index enters only linear. That's crucial. Why? Because you can solve it with respect, for example, to phi 2 dot, always, because it's linear in phi 2 dot. And then you satisfy the conditions of Cauchy-Kowalewski theory. So that means that if you have proper initial conditions, then at least for them you can say that you have, like reasonably, not reasonably posed, but reasonably formulated Cauchy problem.
Yeah, but just two questions. So the Cauchy-Kowalewski is for analytical data.
Exactly. And so that's what I meant, proper data.
Well, no, well, I mean, we don't know if you're going to have always analytical data, right? I mean, we could have just G2 or some finite subgroup space. So, typically, people, so Cauchy-Kowalewski is kind of minimum you should ask, but that doesn't mean you're going to have something that's well defined.
Of course.
The other thing, given that you're now, so you're going up away from something that mathematicians know well, so you're outside a linearly degenerate case.
Exactly. So it is not a quasi-linear equation, and I was looking at the literature. If you know any paper.
No, there's nothing. I mean, there's
exactly.
And so that's like the you're on your own.
That's exactly the point. That's why I'm not referring and not saying that the Cauchy problem is well posed, because that we don't know. The only thing what we do know that proceeding naively in like was done by Leray. What you can do, you can expand it by, in general background, you expand it, you look at the metric which will describe high frequency modes. This equation is already linear, and then you look when is it hyperbolic. That you can do.
Right, but that's a technique that is well defined for quasi-linear problem, for
exactly.
Quasi-linear problem. So
exactly.
Here you're using the technique from one camp into the other one, and we don't know whether that's valid.
Yeah, but you see, naively, physical condition says, of course, it's far away that it's mathematically true. But naive intuition is the following, sir. Why the Ray theorem works? You expand it around something, you use high frequency limit, you look at this metric which is defined by each cache slice, and theoretically what you can say is that the metric around perturbation, around background, can be the metric around your initial data. You use your initial data as your background, okay? And then you look whether the propagation happens in Lorentzian signature, if you want. Here, because it's second order equation, logic can be the same. But we are not claiming that it should be the same.
Okay.
We don't know. That's a very good point. I would be very happy to learn more about it. So these guys from Waterloo, from Applied Mass, they said that this is a very active area of research in like mathematics. But I don't know. So usually people write this quantum pair equation in two dimensions and in Euclidean space. So that's a bit the truth.
Can you tell us what happens when you plug in the Einstein equation into that Ricci thing and what the whole thing looks like?
Yeah.
Okay.
But you know, I would not like to talk about this horrible equation. I'd like to simplify. Okay. So then what can we do? Okay. Let's introduce shift current. Okay. So I don't assume that there is shift symmetry, though. Okay. But if you recall the structure of other Lagrange equations, then there is always something, some gradient of something, some current. Okay. And in fact, if you have shift symmetry, this current is what is conserved. Then introduce new equivalent Lagrangian, which I denote by some weird logic as P. And then in this equivalent Lagrangian is just the previous Lagrangian plus total derivative. And then my horrible equation, which I was writing there, simplifies to some conservation law. Or if you want, non-conservation law. Okay? So depending, so whether this thing is a derivative of this function P with respect to phi, by keeping everything else constant. Okay? So if you have shift symmetry, then this current J is conserved. So now, that you should not recall, because this is just for completeness how these currents and formulas look like, because I would never be able to write them. Okay? So, now, once again, the structure of these equations is really weird, because what you have Einstein equations which depend on phi, the mu phi, the phi, j, dj, dj. But if you look at this equation of motion, it is the same structure. Okay? Not the same structure from how they are organized, but it's the same derivatives which appear in there. And this means that, first of all, the system is not diagonal, we cannot solve them separately. And secondly, the characteristics of cone of propagations, if you want, for small perturbations, they will depend on what external matter is doing, because there is this, theoretically, you should kind of make this matrix triangle. And in that case, you would put back what you have there, what you have for matter. Okay? So now, let's go to hydrodynamical language. Because this simplifies these horrible equations a lot. They all collapse as a black hole. Okay? They're very simple constructions. So, here in a scalar field, okay, how can we organize for velocity? Now, suppose we want to deal with hydrodynamics. So, hydrodynamics means that something is evolving in time, not just purely in space. Okay? So if something is evolving in time, then, well, this phi is evolving in time, then the derivative of this phi should be time-like. Yeah, that's quite natural assumptions. So whatever this time-like, we don't know how to organize for velocity out of this time-like derivative. Well, let's just normalize it, okay? Divided by this square root of 2x. Then we introduce this inverse t, yeah, which is just projected, orthogonal to u. Then we introduce time derivative is just derivative, of course, with respect to this u. Then introduce acceleration, which is the derivative of u with respect to this time. And then introduce expansion. So expansion is the divergence of u, or what is important, so the physical meaning of this is that if you take a congruent volume which moves together with u, infinitesimal and small, then it's v dot divided by v. Okay, in cosmology this is 3h. So now, let's do the following. So let's, if we can assume and we have this current, which definitely simplifies our discussion a lot, let's see what is the charge density. Yeah, so the current was shift charge current. So let's see what is the charge density. We project this current onto u, and we get that there is charge density, and this charge density is very non-standard way. So it has a contribution, it just depends on phi and x, and first derivative of phi, and it has a contribution, this is some function which also depends on x and phi, and this has a contribution which also depends on this divergence. Okay? Then we can calculate energy density. Standard way, we take 10 mu as variation with respect to the metric, and then we see there is also a part of energy density which depends only on phi and first derivatives of phi, and there is a piece which depends on expansion. Okay? If you recall, in perfect fluids, then usually the piece which depends on expansion is the pressure, and that would mean that you have bulk viscosity. So your pressure knows how volume is changing. Okay? Here, you have it already in energy density. And then what you can do, what is the definition of chemical potential or injection mass? Okay? You take this energy density, you take the derivative of energy density with respect to your charge density, and you have to assume that you don't change the volume. And as you have seen from this construction of velocity, phi is kind of your internal clock. Yeah? Because phi is always time-like, and it's built into your theory. So that's why if you want to do some hydrodynamics, obviously that this phi should not change when you take this derivative, because otherwise it corresponds to not only changing the state of the fluid, but also moving. Okay? And I don't want to move, I want just to change the state. So, if you calculate this derivative, then you will figure out that it's square root of 2x, and the square root of 2x is in fact phi dot. Okay? And that's the chemical potential or mass per this charge. So this, you wouldn't be surprised, this exactly corresponds to, it's exactly what Bernard Schultz has written in, I think, 1969 for perfect fluids. Okay? Here, however, it's not perfect. First of all, one can see, okay, we have this current, let's expand this current in u, and what else is there? Okay? And what you will see is that this current is just, well, just normal motion of these charges with the speed u, plus a term which is purely special. Okay? And this purely special term is just the derivative of this m, just the derivative of this chemical potential. And if you look, as many Russians are saying, in the book, Landau Lifshitz, volume 6, paragraph 59, then you would realize that this is exactly how people are constructing imperfect fluids. So namely, what's the physical reason of that? So you have a flow of something, current of something, okay? So normally it would be transported with this u, okay? But then suppose you have kind of off-equilibrium situation where somewhere chemical potential is larger or smaller. The system is trying to bring chemical potential everywhere being the same. So that's why there should be new contributions to the current. It should be, in simplest case, just linearly proportional to this derivative. You should try to equilibrate. So here, what we have, okay? Despite the point that we started from non-dissipative system. So that corresponds to diffusion. So the particles would try to diffuse somewhere where the chemical potential is different. So that's why this kappa, which is just unsurprisingly proportional to the derivative of g with respect to x, because if this derivative is zero, then we end back in perfect fluids. So, this happens a diffusion of transport coefficient. Now we can go further with this machinery, find the pressure, and the pressure has a contribution, once again, which it does depend only on first derivatives and phi, and then there is definitely off equilibrium contribution, which is just time derivative of this m. Okay.
So it is a bit weird to have, I guess, an imperfect, like random description of a viscous terms, because you should have, well, like you say, energy loss, you should have non-unitarity, essentially. I would expect that Lagrangian to be non-unitary if you had dissipation.
Yeah.
But now here you're saying you have dissipation, but you still have
I don't think that's not. I don't think it's necessarily dissipation. That does look like diffusion, but
so there's no dissipation.
Yeah, because it's conserved energy. Energy is conserved.
Everything is just because it's from the action. And action was generic covariant, that means that the meaning is constructed. It's not dissipated, see? So, but let's go further.
So you have no shear stress?
I don't have shear stress, I have only bulk viscosity.
Only
bulk
viscosity and
this kind of diffusion.
Yeah, diffusion from the terminal.
Yeah, but I don't have temperature. Mm-hmm. Okay, so...
So, if you had taken, instead of your definition of U mu, I mean, there was some choice to be made in what the before velocity was.
Yeah.
So if you had taken the U mu to be the local four vector in which T mu nu, you know, in which there was no spatial momentum current, you had taken it as a flow of energy.
Yeah. You want to go in on Lowly's
charge
frame.
Would not, what?
You would want to go in on Lowly's frame. That's what you want to say.
Okay. So then do you find that the charge current is misaligned with that?
Yes.
So it's the charge current and the
energy
current
are not the same. Moreover, why this reference frame? Neither Eckert frame.
So I mean, even if you, because then you would your charge current and.
Mm-hmm. Okay, look, there are two frames usually. People usually are working in this perfect fluid hydrodynamics. It's either as you said on the Lowly's frame, but for that you need the existence of a unique time-like eigenvector for your time union. Okay, this, by the way, is not always true here. So you can move theoretically. If it is true, you could move together with the energy, but not always here. That's the first thing. Second thing, the U defined in this way would not be vorticity-less, because here, as you can see, it's a potential flow, it's a relativistic potential flow, because the vorticity of U is zero, because it's just proportional to the gradient. If you go to the Landau-Lifshitz frame, which you not always can do, you lose this property. So you'll have time which is kind of has vorticity, okay? That's not really good property, because, for example, you would not be able to define a hypersurface as orthogonal to that, okay? So that's why this phi is better to use. On the other hand, you could go to Eckert frame, which moves together with particles, which moves together with this J. It doesn't mean that it exists always, because as you can see, this J can be space-like. Okay? That's why not always this reference frame exists. But even if you go there, that doesn't mean that you move together with energy. Okay? So that's why this choice of frame, it's of course important thing, but this choice is the most natural, the simplest one like generation. So what is important for us? In fact, that one can also find what is the energy flow, and all the definitions are standard, this and this one. And what you can see, this energy flow is purely caused by diffusion. So namely, I said you what is my energy per particle, then there is orthogonal flux, special flux of these particles. So what is my energy flow? In that case, I take this energy and multiply it with this orthogonal flux. Okay? And that's what you obtain here. Just from taking straightforward definition of that, you obtain that it's just that. And this transport coefficient kappa plays a crucial role, because if you look at this energy flow, then it is just proportional with this proportionality kappa to the special gradient of m. So energy flows and tries to make it equal.
The picture that what I have is so it's a scalar field that's dumping energy into the metric by its coupling, and this is why if you, or vice versa, and but then when you do hydrodynamics, you have to fix a background metric, and then so your tensor.
No, I'm not fixing background metric because I can do hydrodynamics in general relativistic theory, which produces a metric. So it is self-consistent theory. So I'm not assuming any given background.
But anyway, I guess I'm just saying, can you think of the diffusion as being just a transfer of charge or energy between the two fields?
I don't know whether it's proper to think about that. Because I don't know what is the diffusion if you take energy from the metric. So I don't know how...
But that cannot be, because you can do all of this in flat space-time as well.
Yeah. So that's not the main deal. Yeah. So,
why do you say no heat flux?
Oh, very simple, because you see, usually, so that's a huge, it's not misunderstanding, but usually, these guys, these Qs, they are called heat fluxes, just per definition. Why? Because, for example, in Newton Wheeler, they're, from the very beginning, using the frame which moves together with particles. That's why they cannot see a kind of diffusive flux of energy. They can only see heat flux, because there's nothing else to propagate.
Okay.
So they move already.
But it's that Q is not heat flux. That's
it's not. It's not, because it's just proportional to the diffusive part of the current. And in fact, if you look in modern literature on like heavy ion collisions, how they define energy flow is the following. So they take that, and then they subtract this part. And that would be your heat flux. But here it is just that. So nothing else. Okay? So then the energy of a condenser takes this imperfect fluid form. Okay? So this part is kind of perfect. However, P and epsilon, they depend on expansions. And this part is this energy flow. What is interesting is that if you want to recover your standard hydrodynamics, what is standard hydrodynamics of perfect fluids? It's small expansion around equilibrium, in fact. And by the way, it doesn't mean that this energy momentum tensor should be conserved because it's an expansion. So here, if you do the same, if you crank up the theory, okay, saying, okay, I'm going to approximate energy momentum tensor, in that case, I can, for example, expand it by small gradients. So second derivative should be kind of small. And in that case, you would recover here bulk viscosity. Okay. So further, there is energy conservation. There is only one scalar equation of motion, which is there, and nothing else. And what you can see, this horrible equation, which I showed you at the beginning, with all this Q alpha beta and whatever, this all this nonsense, in fact, has very simple physical meaning. Take co-moving volume, V, take energy, which is in this V, so epsilon multiplied with V, and then look how this energy would change when this volume moves. And unsurprisingly, you will find it's minus PdV plus M dN. This dN, so this is a small sign diff, means that if I have particle production, if I don't have shift symmetry, then here I should only take the particles which came into the volume through the diffusion, but not those which were produced there, because they are kind of already counted inside. So then what you also can see is that by these definitions of energy density, chemical potential, particle density, and pressure, you just recover standard Euler relation. Okay? Just no mystic, but still, it's quite interesting that you recover all standard laws from just a single scalar field. So however, as you may guess, so Euler relation is only usually valid for equilibrium states. Yeah.
So what is P naught?
P naught is the part of pressure which doesn't have high derivatives inside. Okay? So if you want, it's what these guys from KVI collision, for example, are called. So they usually call this part as thermodynamical pressure. In the sense that this is kind of in equilibrium. Okay? And in our language it means that it only cares about those derivatives. So what you can see that this Euler relation, in fact, guarantees you the momentum conservation. Obviously, there is only one scalar field, there is only one scalar equation of motion, and this only one scalar equation of motion, if you don't have other matter, is just equivalent to the energy momentum tensor conservation. So, but energy momentum tensor conservation is four equations. So that's why all these three are just guaranteed by this just form, how we define this epsilon and P and so on. Okay, so now coming back, so why is this Euler relation is so nice and useful? It's a very simple point. So if there are no particles, no charges, okay? Then in usual hydrodynamics, no particles, no story. So everything disappears. Here, these particles are just shift charges. So that means that they can compensate each other and still have energy. So in fact, what you can see, so if n is equal to zero, then epsilon is just minus p. Okay? So you would be practically in exactly sitter, provided this were really normal perfect scalar field, perfect hydrodynamics. But here you are not, because this total pressure which you care about is in fact combination which contains also this part. But if you are evolving slowly, then you are in the sitter, okay? Quasi de sitter. That's what makes it interesting for cosmology, because now let's go to cosmology. All this hydrodynamical stuff is very easy to apply to cosmology. How you do it? You kill the special vector, Q is zero. You write instead of your expansion 3H. Then what is interesting, by writing Friedman equation, recall your energy density had expansion. Expansion is h. That means that your Friedman equation has now a term which is linear in h. And that's exactly what people had in DGP. So this guy, kappa m, which is kind of your scale of diffusion, if you want, it's in fact the crossover scale for DGP. However, now it is dynamic. Moreover, I can say you that you can recover exactly DGP equation for Friedman equation. Like really exact, literally. However, it will be always unstable, this theory. Always. No way. It will either have some speed which is imaginary, or it will have ghosts. Okay, so now if you go further to cosmology, let's write this charge consideration, and it's much simpler. Then let's say that there is a shift symmetry, okay, for simplest cosmological application. In that case, well, we just write shift charges, so n going like a minus 3. And then, obviously, if you put the scalar field, if it was there with some initial data during inflation, then inflation completely dilutes all these particles, and you are to come into this attractor, to this configuration, where there's no shift charge to neutral configuration. Now let's see how it works in the simplest case. Let's take simplest action of this type. So basically, it is DGP decoupling limit with the only difference we crank up the sign. Okay? It's minus. And this mu is just one single parameter, one single free parameter, which is obviously 1 over m cubed. Okay? So now we can write shift charge density, and what we can see, it has two different zeros. Okay?
So what is m?
M is phi dot, or square root of 2x, or chemical potential.
Sorry, just so I understand, what's your convention? So what's the sign of the kinetic term?
It's the wrong sign kinetic term.
Wrong sign.
Yeah. That's important. So this theory is extremely bad if you go to normal wire. It's ghosty. So now let's see what are the solutions when there are no particles, no charges. So the standard one, which is shadow, which is not interesting because it's ghosty. Okay? And there are no particles, no story, we repeat the same normal stuff. But due to this construction, there is a different solution, like in ghost condensate, where this m star is equal to this combination. Of course, it's a nonlinear combination because h also depends on m star. Here is this simple theory, one can solve it, and what we will see is that this is a particular solution, and for this particular solution, you just see how h would depend on your external matter, rho external. And you see, theoretically, if I had I written a more complicated Lagrangian, obviously this would be a more complicated function of rho external. But that's what people are calling Cartesian models, whatever. But you see, the point is, if you don't know about this scalar field, and this scalar field isn't this solution, you will look in your Friedman equation and say, it's very different from what you would expect. But that's because there's a particular solution which you have chosen. And this is stable. Okay? Why? Sorry about that. This maybe too technical, because one can calculate this metric, okay, acoustic metric or whatever it's called, and it's very hard to analyze it, but in fact, in simple cosmological context, it's quite easy. So you have a component which is proportional to u, okay, and this is a component which corresponds to basically, if you want, the sign in front of delta phi dot squared in your action for perturbation. So it is this quantity which defines you whether you do have ghosts or not. Okay? So this thing looks like that, and it has contributions which are proportional to kappa squared, which are non-trivial. There is another quantity which I don't want to deal with, and one can define the sound speed because it's very easy to see. So in cosmology, this guy drops out. Out of this guy, you only have expansion, so this is extrinsic curvature for hypersurfaces of constant phi. So out of this guy, you only have 3h multiplied with the same projector, and these guys are simple, okay? So this metric will immediately collapse to just another Friedman-Robertson all-two metric. However, in front of dt, you will have cs squared. So now this sound speed, sorry, we have not found any simpler way to write it, but what is important, so it does contain time derivative of k, of kappa. So that means that in order to analyze what is going on there, you need to solve your equation and plug it in back. Okay? It has h inside, what makes it very, very non-standard. And obviously, well, it has standard components, p over the derivative of dp over dm and d epsilon over dm. So that's obviously it's not p dot over epsilon dot, it's not dp over d epsilon or whatsoever. Okay?
So when you say epsilon m, you mean epsilon of the scalar field?
Yeah. Anything what is external is inside of H.
Yeah.
So now we can use the phase portrait of the system. And now we have two variables, basically phi dot, so nothing was depending on phi. So we are going to homogeneous case, and there is external matter. Then one can see, okay, this is a subtractive solution where there are no particles. Then there is a place where you have normal equation of states, so normal, hard to say, but larger than minus one. Here you have smaller than minus one, so this guy is phantomy, but not ghosty, okay? And here you have kind of boundary, here you have ghosty initial data, so that would be ghosty. But this boundary, it's exactly where this quantity d is zero. But as you may guess, d is exactly what would appear there if you solve m dot.
Sorry,
D
is what again?
D is this thing. Oops. This guy. Okay? Namely, throw away all these kappa terms, okay? And m is positive. In that case, it's a derivative of energy density with respect to chemical potential. Namely, it's obvious, if I increase my energy, if my theory is normal, the more energy per one particle I have, the more is my energy. Okay? That's why it's related to whether it's ghosty or not. Here, due to these contributions, you have more. Okay. So, but what's important is, in fact, pressure diverges on this line. So it's a pressure singularity, you cannot penetrate this region, you never go from one region to another one. So if nobody puts your initial data there, you're never there, you don't care. Okay, and now it's obvious, if you take this, obviously it was evolving to de Sitter because m dot would decrease. I take my, on this solution, on my attractor, I take my expression from my Friedman equation. And I see that if I want that it evolves to just normal de Sitter with given lambda, and in order to have it as lambda now, I should put my mu, my only scale in this model, okay? My only non-dynamical scale, the only number we should plug in. I will get 10 minus 13 electron volts, which correspond to the scale 1000 kilometers. So, from the particle perspective, particle physics perspective point of view, well, or people say high energy physics point of view, that's of course nonsense, okay, because it's high energy. But if you compare this with quintessence, then you realize the only parameter which you kind of plug in quintessence is the mass. And this mass is of the order of h, and this is the size of the universe. So this is 10 minus 33 electron volts, so we gain 20 orders of magnitude. Of course, looking at this 10 minus 13, it's still not a pleasant thing, but also, what is important is that this mass and quintessence we don't know how to control. And this guy is already an irrelevant operator, and it's hard to know what are the corrections there. At least they not necessarily should really go like k to the square. Okay?
What is that 1000 kilometers? I kind of missed this. How did he get 1000 kilometers?
Okay, you see, this is this mu. Okay, this is the only parameter available there. Then this is h on this solution. Now, suppose this rho external is very small, okay? So it's diluting, yeah? So you consider phi where asymptotics, and suppose your junior is normal, rho external is normal, okay? It decreases. So at some moment this term will be dominant, then you have 1 over rho, you have rho and rho cancels out, you have constant. And this constant is just, it's just that. Okay. And then I just wondered, it's what about the total now?
And that gives you 1000 kilometers per mu?
Can you show us where that trajectory is in your previous diagram of that one?
So this red one?
Yeah.
This is our trajectory which we consider as a fractal. So if there was inflation somewhere here, it brought me already here. And I'm kind of exponentially close to this fractal. If, of course, I start like much later, and my initial data somewhere here, then I will approach it much later. But theoretically, all these lines are going like that. because it's an attractor.
So you what value of W are you tending towards?
I will show you a picture. Okay, so that's if I am on attractor, and that's the evolution of three most interesting quantities. So W, omega, and CS. So now I'm on attractor, so that's my W. And this W, of course, in the late time asymptotic would approach just minus one. That's why it's here. But if you fix it that we are here today, okay, today we still have finite raw dark matter, so it's not completely empty. So that's why our W now it's slightly different. Okay? So that was the energy density because it was very ghosty at the beginning. As you can see here, W initially was minus 2 and minus 2.5, whatever. So basically, if you trace it back, you fix already this number. Yeah? You don't know that that's the energy density now. If it is ghosty, then the energy density in ghosts is increasing. It means that if you go in the past, that's decreasing. So that's basically almost zero. And the sound speed is here. Okay? Here in the far away, it was even a bit superluminal, but it's not a problem.
Why not?
Why not? Yeah. Well, very simple reason, because you see, your metric, it is just a metric, I mean, acoustic metric for the signals. It's just a metric for Friedman-Robertson-Olkin. This is the CS. So instead of take Friedman-Robertson-Olkin, instead of C, put CS. Okay? And in Robertson-Olkin, there are no post-standard curves. There are no pathologies with causality. So you cannot send signals back in your own past. You cannot communicate with your grandfather, you can only send signals forwards. It's trivial configuration. If you want, we can discuss it more.
Can I ask?
Yeah.
When you say that the model has only one parameter, and you take this mu and you get 10 to the minus 13 eV, I mean, but it does have also the Planck mass. I mean, that coefficient there might be the mass, the relevant mass scale times some power of Planck mass.
That's we just have converted. Of course, it depends how you write it. If you write the M Planck inside, then it will be different mass scale.
Right.
But we just. Saying.
Yeah.
We just wrote it box phi divided by mu cube, if you want.
It just doesn't seem like doesn't seem like you can clearly identify the relevant mass scale or whatever. So, like, it's not clear that it's as bad as what you did as 10 to the minus 13. 10 to the minus 13 sounds like a weird scale, but that could really be quite a normal scale. But
of course, you can you see having two masses, you can produce whatever mass scale you want.
Right.
But you know, you need some definition of what you're doing. So the normal language is saying if you have a relevant operator divided by mass scale in the power which is needed to bring it to normal dimensions. And that's the only mass scale that I was talking about. If you include the M Planck, I can write M Planck power 100 there. That will be very small mass scale in that case, very large depending where I put M Planck power 100.
Sorry, I
want to
add, can you clarify how this is different from DGP? Or, I mean, you mentioned that, I mean, I guess. That's actually, I think DGP has ghosts, but
yeah.
We don't have ghosts.
We don't have ghosts, exactly.
So then these are not the same theories. So there are other things, like is there a Weinstein effect here?
Yeah, there is Weinstein effect, and there's.
Similar to DGP.
It's not really exactly similar because it's a different theory.
Okay.
But you see, you could recover exact Friedman equation for DGP. But if you look at that, what are the G function and K function you need for that, this theory would be same. Would not have either sound speed positive or it will be ghost. But ghost means the perturbations will be ghost.
And have you thought about whether the binary pulsar would decay at the right rate in this theory or would it emit?
Well, I'm almost sure they will because for Bryce's Weinstein argument, if you want to recover the same series, this degree of freedom here is basically absent. But that's a good point. So here it's off attractor, but let me go to more interesting things. So that's our prediction because we have now dynamic of the energy. We should rethink our observations, okay? So that's basically, if you put, that's W now, and that's W prime, or W at redshift 0.5, and this thing shows you a color of the omega, okay, in this component. So you can see that if you want to be somewhere where people are thinking now, then you're kind of here. And this is sort of a slightly different parameterization. So what I wanted to tell you so that, in fact, we are living the age of precise cosmology. That's what is impressive, okay? So you can take this absolutely nonsensical, exotic theory, and then you can go and check the data, okay? So we are not so data-oriented guys, that's why they came, these guys from Japan, so Kimura and Yamamoto, and then just plugged in, so we, in our paper, we discussed all possible functions, okay? They just took monodels and checked if you're on a tractor, what would be the data if you change the power of this monodel. So they looked at the following thing. So you can see what is the W effective if you're on a tractor, if you change this N. Okay? So this is our model which I just described in details. And then they go up and up if you increase N. So the larger is N, the closer you are to lambda CDM. Okay? So here you can see the proper distance.
You should accelerate, otherwise we will be really over time.
And what is really crucially important, they took distance measurements with supernova 1A and with CMB. And of course, supernova 1As are not so precise, so theoretically we still would be fine even with n equal 1, but if you go to CMB, you are not, okay? So what the constraint, basically what they said, that n should be, well, if you look here, approximately this n should be larger than 3, but in fact it should be larger than probably 4 or 5, and if you go to 4 or 5, then still you have one parameter there, okay, in the section. Then this length scale which corresponds to this parameter would go to really scale of like method. Okay? So you are back to 1/10 millimeter. And this would not be excluded. Then there's this data on the growth factor and so on. Also, one can distinguish the different models. And this is what is related to your question about Weinstein mechanism. So here, if you look on linear perturbations, how they grow, and if you check what is the effective Newton's constant which appears in these equations, only for perturbations, not for like circular motion or whatever, just for perturbations around cosmology. So there you just try to bring it to normal way and you see that the constant should be different for the case. So you see, in linearly, this G grows, but if it goes non-linearly, it just, you know, saturates and then goes down. So this thing is just one, it's not zero, that's important. Then if you look at sound speed, if you increase n, you should be closer to lambda CDM. If you're close to some lambda CDM, then the sound speed in lambda CDM is almost zero. Okay? Then you're going closer to zero. So this is, for example, for n equal 5, and this one for n equal 1. Okay?
So you don't get become superluminal after all?
No, if you don't like superluminal. You see, you
no,
can write...
n equals 5 is always subluminal.
Right? Yeah. I think they have even conditioned lambda is exactly subluminal everywhere to subtract. Okay, thanks a lot for your attention. So, are there any additional questions?
Well, I have one. So, have you looked at the matter power spectrum, how it changes?
Well, we have not.
Yeah, huh? I mean, look at the growth factor, it seems, right?
Yes, these guys, they would. So, see, that's exactly the point. So, this thing. Yeah.
Because, I mean...
They have a simple picture for gamma.
I mean, the thing is that if you have a smaller speed of sound, then the shape of your power spectrum might change. Because,
Sure.
There's basically gene's length for your scalar field.
Of course. It will contribute to the structure formation.
Yeah.
But you see, what I would say is a non-trivial question, because especially if you want to go non-linearly, then it's definitely a very complicated issue, because
sure, but even at
a
linear level,
that's cool. Yeah, but it seems that, you see, the point is, you could change your theory. This was, these guys were claiming that higher n are okay. But, you know, exactly, I don't know.
Like, for example, that n of 5, a speed of sound is like, what is it? I cannot. Is it
0.1.
Okay.
But yeah. The speed of sound squared, so that's why it's probably.
So the speed of
sound.
Yeah. Speed of sound is squared. That's the speed of sound is squared, right?
Yeah.
So that's 0.1. So the speed of sound is the square root of that one. So basically, on a scale of, I don't know, 20% of Hubble radius, you're going to have this, like a kink or something like that in the power spectrum, because that's
right.
Where.
But see, on the other hand, it's hard, because still you have W, which is approximately -1. So you need to. Probably sound speed is more important, I would guess, but
But still, it's not so trivial because it's still not dust.
W is not exactly minus one, is it?
It's not, but it's even smaller than this one.
Well,
yeah.
As long as there is a W.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It would be
there is.
It's not minus one, yeah.
That's of course,
yeah, valid point.
But you see, theoretically, we are discussing infinite amount of the series. And taking into account, now let's take more a different perspective. We started from a scalar field. Let's start from particles, okay? And let's say that this thing is exactly this imperfect thermodynamics. In that case, we may open any book on thermodynamics and see what are equations of state you can produce. It is crazy functions, okay? Not to talk about transport coefficients and how can they depend on chemical potentials. So what here looks completely unnatural, like m power 10, yeah? So that's crazy. If somebody writes you a theory where you have kinetic term power 10 multiplied with box phi, you think, oh, this guy is definitely crazy. However, if you think, oh, that's a transport coefficient, but if you look what are the functions which appear there, then it's probably okay. And obviously, in that case, this phi is not a fundamental scalar field, it's a velocity potential. Okay? There are no fundamental issues with that, it's probably even wrong even to quantize it just because, well, it's somehow your distribution, statistical distribution moves, it's already quantized before. So that, but that's a subtle question because we don't know.
So real quick, you went from 1,000 meters to much smaller scale,
yeah.
And that kind of went quite fast, so what happened?
Oh, it's very simple, so if you want, you basically have
1,000 kilometers.
Kilometers.
I have 1,000 kilometers, and now I reduce my scale by 10 power 10, if you want. How it happens, because you see, here it is a power law dependent, so h here was 1 over m cubed, but if you go to x power n, then your power changes. And that's why basically you introduce coefficients which are kind of this scale divided by Planck scale power 5, for example, and introduce something.
So it just came about because n can't be 1 and be consistent. Okay.
Yeah, okay. It depends on this power, on this n. And, but the funny thing, if you approach n like 5, for example, then you approach basically the normal scale because it's the same moving kind of like.
It was the CMB that was used
to
abandon n equals 1, right?
Yeah.
So what did it do to the
CMB? Oh, they just measured the distance to the first peak.
Okay, so it was a geometrical.
Yeah.
So this is less scattering.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just distance.
You know, this is dynamically simple, that is, are there tachyons in it?
Well, tachyons, you see, so theoretically, if you write perturbations, then perturbations are, in a sense, massless, yeah, because the theory was just symmetric. That's why, namely, tachyons cannot be there because you should have a negative mass.
Well, there are different notions of tachyons.
Exactly.
Which can be so the question here was, if I take a small perturbation, are the things that grow rapidly?
No. You see, that's exactly the point. It depends. So now you probably refer to tachyons. I think it's a misuse of words, what the people usually say. I'm not talking about you, but usually people say, at least some people say, the tachyons are those fluctuations for which you have some speed squared less than zero.
There are several different meanings,
exactly,
of the word tachyon, which may or may not overlap in particular contexts.
Yeah.
So the question I had was, if I take small perturbation, does it stay small or does it get big?
It depends, as usual in cosmology, on your k, on your wavelength of this perturbation. So if your wavelength is large, then you cannot avoid Jones instability, which is if you want tachyonic instability, because you kind of have effective mass negative. That's standard for all matter. Okay? If you take fast or like small scale objects, which don't care about gravity, then they do care about the sound speed, and sound speed here is positive, so that's why they don't grow. Contrary to exactly like series like this Gauss condensate, yeah, where the sound speed is negative and you need to regularize it by k to the 4. Because that's the only way for you. So there will be some region where they're growing, but then they're not growing, but you need to say where, how you cut it off this dispersion relation and whiteness and so on. So here you don't need all those things.
The other kind of instability you might worry about is an energetic one. That is, if you have a wrong sign kinetic term, you might worry that at least locally your vacuum can produce essentially negative energy density states. And then at least the vacuum is going to quantum mechanically be in real trouble.
So that's exactly the point. So here the perturbations have positive kinetic terms. So globally, your global Hamiltonian, you don't know whether it's positively defined or not, but locally you have a minima, and this around this minima, you are absolutely
yeah,
safe.
Yeah, no. So if you say you do it locally, fine, but that doesn't say that there's not a non-perturbative instability.
Oh, non-perturbative instabilities, maybe there. But that's, I don't know how to build it.
Yeah, but not to keep pressing the same point, but I mean, you're saying it's absolutely safe and using arguments like this, you don't know.
It's linearly safe.
Because you're, I would even disagree with that, because you're using intuition from one set of equations into a completely new set where it may hold or may not. We really don't know. I'm pretty sure someone can sit down and write a counterexample to your...
If you can, I would be extremely happy.
Okay.
So we have not succeeded, because you see, the point is, For perturbations, that's definitely true. If you want to go non-linearly to produce some bounds on growth, you know, like what...
No, but what I'm saying is even the concept of characteristic cone or characteristic structure requires on the quasi-linear structure being there. You don't have it to begin with. So everything you claim and you bring from this other Kant from here, it's not even clear that applied.
Because look, I'm a physicist, so I think physical. And physical thinking implies, if I have my initial data, it's enough for me to solve with respect to phi to m dot or phi to dot. Then I plug this phi to dot in my metric which I have calculated. Doesn't matter what does it mean, that's a different story, okay? Because non-quasi-linear equations, they don't have characteristics in normal sense. Exactly. But I know that my initial data, if I plug it in on a computer, I calculated every analysis.
Use the same argument before in Ann Arbor, and I repeat, and I'm going to come back with the same argument I gave you. For 20 years in numerical relativity, we showed that the Einstein equations just were crap. So it's not okay to say that you can put it in the computer and the computer will tell you. You have to work really hard, even with a very well posed theory, to make it work. So now if you put this in the computer, I would bet my house if you want that it's going to get crap. So there's a lot of...
Now it's going to be interesting. Wait a second. I don't have a house. Let's talk more about that.
What my point is, it's very hard to make it work.
I agree.
It's a very well-closed system, so I don't know what's going to happen here.
Look, I completely agree. My simple arguments are very physically motivated from the point of view of linearization, and that's the standard tool in everywhere. GR was very complicated because of the presence of constraints. Not only because the theory is nonlinear, but because it has constraints. And nobody knew how to solve these constraints properly. That was the main issue in numerical GR, as far as I understand. So
it's more than that.
It's more than that, of course, but you see, and it has more degrees of freedom. Here, the degree of freedom is 1, and there are no constraints.
But it's
capital
GR.
It is.
So you can come back and punch on the outside.
Exactly, but you see, what you could do theoretically, you could say, okay, people who are doing imperfect hydrodynamics, by the way, they also would have this R there, okay? So now I can forget about this R and work in flat space-time. And this would be, by the way, quite a reasonable approximation. For example, if you work for series with CS, which is large, I mean, 1/3, 1 divided by square root of 3. In that case, I'm fine. As all people who are doing in proper in imperfect fluids, because there, if you look, they have high derivatives. If they want to write it coherently, they will have all these problems, and even worse. So see, I'm not using very weird arguments. Moreover, if you look, so of course nobody has proven even the existence of normal Navier-Stokes solutions. So that's definitely true. It doesn't disturb us from using it and calculating how airplanes are flying. By the way, that's a good argument, yeah? If you look here, there is a more subtle analogy, because your Navier-Stokes is usually bad because it assumes kind of linear viscosity, shear viscosity. But as we know from Nadezhdinskaya, for example, one can even find one can prove that Navier-Stokes equations have exact solutions in the domain which you can give, provided that you crank up your viscosity and say that it's dynamical, that it's non-linear. Here, if you want, we have this nonlinear viscosity, however, the bulk viscosity, because it reproduces you only this theta and p, only linear expansion. If you go nonlinear, there will be k, so the extrinsic curvature squared, and all these terms. So see, I would strongly disagree with this argument that it definitely not work. But I would agree that there are many series where you could create caustics and thousand singularities.
No, I wouldn't say it's not going to work, but what I was arguing is again saying, oh, this is going to be absolutely safe.
No. Look, it's linear analysis. I'm a simple-minded man. I'm a physicist who is doing like linear perturbation theory. In terms of linear perturbation theory, it works. How to do it non-linearly, or how to do the global analysis and put functional spaces where the initial data are well posted, how to produce bounds, how it will grow, that's, I don't know. I would be extremely interested to learn it, but you see, we are happy to reformulate it at least in this in Japan and not see these equations in Japan just long. But of course, it's absolutely right at point.
Okay, well, thanks very much. So another talk at Elon, right?
Oh.
In the terminal, so. Okay, that's